sure is.
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, sometime this week, I crossed a line. A line which one could have seen coming in the distance, or one approaching the line, actually, could have seen it seeming to get nearer when one was... You know what I mean. Anyway, it's a line that defines a new era in the digital wonderland. I've been staying in a rented house here in Edinburgh, Scotland. Think of it. It's one of several rented houses I've had occasion to stay in over the past year or so. As you know, you just get so peripatetic, you have to lay your weary frame down every once in a while. And I've noticed, as I've been in these rented houses, lovely dwellings all, that the once simple task, ladies and gentlemen, of turning on a television set has now become fraught. You know, it was a big technological innovation in the 1970s when Sony swept the American TV marketplace with a little thing called Instant On. You no longer had to wait for your TV to warm up before you could get the jolt of video satisfaction. It was Instant On. How could we ever turn our back on that? We have. And so much more. So I'm in this rented house in Edinburgh. Lovely dwelling, as I say. And pick up the two remotes, two of the three. One is clearly for the DVD, but then there's a set-top box and a TV. Each, of course, has their own remote. And my wife and I are trying to figure out, you know, how to watch some TV. I know. We should be ashamed of our... There we were. Couldn't help it. And there's a list, a sheet of instructions, you see. This is new. I don't think when you went into a rented house 20 years ago, you needed a sheet of instructions to tell you how to turn on the TV. But there it is. And we tried following the sheet of instructions. Long story short, many, 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 many clicks of many, many buttons on both remotes finally get to a point where we can watch a sprinkling of a selection of channels. Because the box is not working. And so I can only see, and those channels now start. And then I walk over to my laptop and utilizing a website that a friend had introduced me to just last week, as if setting me up for this rant. I did four clicks on the laptop and was watching any one of hundreds of channels live on British television. Which is to say, ladies and gentlemen, the line we've crossed is it's now easier to watch TV on your computer than on your TV. Hello, welcome to the show.
Your head's down, your head clamped, you had everything to make a love last. You had you had charm, you had me hanging on your arm. When I found out you were a fake, you ran up and bit me like a snake. And I wasn't ready to let go and let all my feelings show. Tell me why you wanna be so cold, why you wanna be so mean. Gonna let your true colors show. You're a perpetual balloon machine. We could have been just fine, only being all mine. I was for real, but you did not know that you were stepping on my heart as you were walking out the door. Now I know just who you are, and it's a damn good thing we didn't get too far. I'm not the one that's right for you. You need a man to do your rolling like you want him to do, baby. Why you wanna be so cold? Why you wanna be so mean? You gonna let your true color show? You're a perpetual blues machine.
Right near the castle in Edinburgh, Scotland. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, the new F-bomb, foreclosure. GMAC is one of the nation's largest mortgage servicers. It wanted to foreclose on a New York City homeowner last year, but lacked the crucial paperwork necessary to seize the property. GMAC normally has a solution, which is to create and sign documents in the name of companies that made the original loans, have its employees do that. But this was trickier because the lender, Ameriquest, had gone out of business in 2007. So GMAC, which was bailed out by taxpayers 3 years ago, looked for a way to craft a document that would pass legal muster. Do we not have signing authority? Are there any other options? Says the head of GMAC's document execution team. Well, GMAC now had an answer. 3 months later, it filed a document with New York authorities that said the delinquent Ameriquest loan had been assigned to it effective of August 2005. The document was dated July 7th, 2010, 3 years after Ameriquest ceased to exist. An examination by the ProPublica website suggests this transaction was not unique. Thousands of similar assignment documents filed in New York in the name of Ameriquest after 2008 by GMAC and other services. But if that doesn't stink enough for you, MERS, remember MERS, the electronic registry of mortgage documents and assignments that the financial industry set up to avoid registering mortgage sales with local and county officials? Well, in rule changes announced late July, the company now forbids members to file any more foreclosure actions in MERS's name, and it requires mortgage servicers to obtain mortgage assignments and record them with county clerks before beginning foreclosures. That is to say, they're going legal. The new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, and there is no shelter. And now, it's time for me to read the trades for you. As if this program weren't informative enough. This is from Adweek. Talking vagina ads aren't racist, says ad agency. Oh, yes, I'll read it for you. Bank, take that to the bank. No, sorry, the bank's closed. Summer's Eve released three videos recently featuring talking hand puppet vaginas as part of its new Hail to the V campaign. It's meant to be about empowering women and rejuvenating the brand. That's following last year's disastrous print ad, which told women to douche before asking for a raise. I'm reading this. These three new ads have created new controversy, with some saying the voice work in the African-American and Latina versions promotes racial stereotypes. The black woman is Pam Grier and Lil' Kim all wrapped in one, writes one critic. While the Latina woman vagina opens with the cry, ay, ay, ay! The larger problem for Summer's Eve, writes Adweek, is that many women see douching products themselves and any marketing of them as anti-woman, i.e. creating a feeling of shame around the issue of cleanliness, then selling the antidote to the shame. Casting the process as female empowerment is particularly galling. For its part, the Richards Group is defending the ad. Agency founder Stan Richards says to Adweek, "We have a wonderful client that recognizes no matter what they do, marketing in the feminine hygiene category is going to provoke a reaction. After listening to thousands of women say they want straight talk and lighthearted communication on a historically uncomfortable topic, Summer's Eve gave us license to be bold, irreverent, and celebratory across a multitude of mediums," I'm quoting, "and to different audiences. We are surprised that some have found the online videos racially stereotypical. We never intended anything other than to make the videos relatable. And our in-house multicultural experts confirm the approach. The more important mission is to get women talking about taboo topics, and we hope these negative sentiments don't overshadow that effort," unquote, Stan Richards from the agency. I think the more important mission is to sell Summer's Eve, Stan. Check your contract. The talking vagina ads are not racist, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it here last. As always, when I read the trades for you, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is Le Show, and it's not tax season, but on the other hand, it's always tax season. And I can imagine that has several people reaching for their dials. But don't do that. A gentleman who has been making taxes and the games played with them comprehensible to mortals like me for many years, going back to his days as the tax writer. He didn't write the tax law. He wrote about it for the New York Times. Is now unveiled as a columnist for Reuters. And I wanted to catch up with him because he's an expert on something that's been catching my eye more and more. David K. Johnston, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. And the subject that I wanted to tackle with you, and it's complex, but you're good at making the complex comprehensible, is this whole idea of offshoring, which you've written about. Can you explain in less than half an hour what offshoring is?
It's actually quite simple conceptually. What you do if you're a business is you take your expenses here in the United States, and then you arrange to collect your profits in a place like the Cayman Islands, Panama, Bermuda, where you will not be taxed on them. A simple example of that is the Viagra tablet. They sell for about $18 each now, and there's a huge profit in that. Well, when the researchers at Pfizer were working on what became Viagra, it was intended to be a heart drug, cardiovascular drug, and some of the male researchers noticed an unusual property. The Pfizer Corporation immediately packaged up the information it had at the time, which wasn't worth very much because it was still experimental, and Pfizer America sold it to Pfizer Switzerland, which in turn licensed it to Pfizer Liechtenstein. And every time somebody buys one of these $18 tablets now, the cost of manufacturing them is a tax deduction in the United States, and the royalty paid on it for the ownership of the intellectual property is tax-free, collected by Pfizer in its Liechtenstein pocket. The result is They pay very little tax. They build up all this money offshore, and you and I have a heavier tax burden.
I've grasped that sort of basic scenario, but then does that money forever live in Liechtenstein?
Well, 7 years ago, Congress passed something called the American Jobs Creation Act.
Well, what could be wrong with that?
You're right. With a name like that, how could you not be in favor of it, right? And right now, there is a proposed new American Jobs Creation Act. And it said if you have offshore profits, you may repatriate them to the United States. And instead of paying the 35% corporate tax, you only have to pay 5.25%. The biggest beneficiary of this law back then was Pfizer. And Pfizer saved $11 billion in taxes. And what happened the day after they repatriated this money for very little tax? They started firing people. And they kept firing people until they fired 40,000 people. I'm not sure that they're through firing people at Pfizer. Now, not all companies did this, but they got one-third of the benefits. And it was clearly an American jobs destruction program. So the new bill, like the old one, actually doesn't require you to create jobs despite its title. You can do all sorts of things with the money. You can use it to finance buybacks of your company stock. And executives, of course, like that because if there's less stock out there and the company's buying it, it tends to push up the price of the stock. And that means their stock options are worth more money. All thanks to the generosity of you and I as taxpayers.
Now, about a year ago, there was a piece, I think, in the Washington Post that went into some detail on this. And I gather this is related to what we're talking about. The double Irish with a Dutch sandwich.
There's an enormous number of devices out there. I wrote about ones many years ago. Peter Wariski at the Washington Post wrote about some of these. But there's a couple of simple basic concepts. You take advantage of tax treaties. So you give you one example. An American corporation, I hope I can remember the name of it, that I wrote about years ago, legally moved its headquarters to Bermuda. All they did was rent a mailbox in Bermuda, and they pay the Bermuda government $26,000 a year for the privilege of, on paper, being a Bermuda company. Nobody works there. They have a mailbox. And they pay some local lawyers very nicely. In order to get money to Bermuda, they take advantage of a tax treaty in Barbados, another British island down in the Caribbean. And lo and behold, to take advantage of that tax treaty, once a year, the directors of the company must fly to Barbados and hold a meeting.
On the poor things.
And as we all know, that's one of the worst possible places in the world to want to go, say, in the middle of January when your company's headquartered in the Northeast.
Yeah.
And they pay effectively a 1% tax on their profits.
Wow. But now this double Irish with the Dutch sandwich, Google and a lot of companies who are heavy with intellectual property were domiciling their IP property in Ireland and then somehow moving it, paying an affiliate in the Netherlands, and then it went back to Ireland and then it ended up in one of the Caribbean islands. Was that sort of the—
Correct. And the Dutch and Dutch banks and German banks like Deutsche Bank and Swiss banks are all very big players in this. Harry, here's the fundamental difference between now and when you and I were little children in terms of taxing businesses. When you and I were born, America was a country of big manufacturing enterprises. There were automobile factories and television factories. And in Southern California, where you and I grew up, big, huge agricultural organizations that had oranges and whatnot.
And aerospace factories.
And aerospace. L.A. was forever and maybe still is the real center of the American war business.
Yeah.
And when a company has a big factory, you can tax that company. It can't get up and move. That's when we made things like that. But today in America, what we principally manufacture are numbers. That's what a software is. It's an algorithm. It's a series of numbers. CDs, all sorts of things are numbers. The other thing we manufacture are molecules. That's what the drugs we get are. Well, the ownership of those things, and in the case of the numbers, the representation of them, you can move outside of the U.S. with the push of a button. And so our tax system still operates as if we lived in a national industrial wage economy when we now live in a global digital services world. And we need to have a fundamental reform of our tax system.
You mean like the kinds of meetings that we've been watching in recent weeks between Democrats and Republicans to craft a fundamental reform of our tax system?
Yeah, first of all, there's no way to fundamentally reform the tax system the way they're doing that. It's an enormous project that will take a number of years to work out. Mm-hmm. That's a game of chicken.
Well, chicken's got to eat, too. We'll be back with more of our interview with David K. Johnston moments from now here on the show. But first, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by James Ebersole Jr. I think many of you have seen by now the jocular re-rendering of the Olympic logo in light of this week's events in London. But this is true from the Telegraph in London. A London 2012 Olympics ambassador who has met London Mayor Boris Johnson and Lord Sebastian Coe, head of the Olympic Committee, has been revealed to be a riot suspect after she was reported to the police by her own mother. 18-year-old Chelsea Ives allegedly threw bricks at a police car during the violence in Enfield this week. She even boasted she'd had, quote, the best day ever, unquote, according to what was testified to in Magistrates Court in Westminster. The teenager was caught after her mother, Adrienne, saw her on a television news report and called the police. Mrs. Ives said her decision was gut-wrenching, but insisted she only did what any honest parent could. I could not believe we saw our daughter among the crowds for a minute. We did not know what to do. But then what could normal, honest parents do? How could you sit there and say that, see that and say, that's okay? As parents, we had to say, she can't get away with that. Unquote. Ives has met the mayor of London as well as the London Olympics chief, Sebastian Coe, as part of her role as a 2012 ambassador, appearing at Westminster Magistrates Court during an all-night session. She denied two counts of burglary, violent disorder, and attacking a police car in the early hours. She was, in 2009, invited into the House of Commons to celebrate the success of a football project run by a community sport program. But the prosecutor now said she, Ives, led the attack on a cell phone store. Quote, she was the first to pick up masonry and hurl it at the window. She was also involved in a mob attack on another phone store. She also allegedly hurled masonry at a marked police BMW. The police drive BMWs in London, no wonder. In a, quote, frenzied attack that forced officers to flee. In their Mercedes, I hope. She was refused bail until August 17th. She was described by her lawyer as a talented sportswoman. But more character building from the Olympics right here. The survivors of the Bhopal gas tragedy in India, as well as those who support their cause worldwide, are protesting Dow Chemical's sponsorship of the 2012 London Olympics. They've threatened to hold a parallel Olympics of those rendered disabled due to toxins from Dow's factories. If the managing committee of the London Olympics does not reconsider its decision, the non-governmental organizations fighting the 1984 Union Carbide disaster case, along with the counterparts of other parts of the world, say they will hold that parallel Olympics. More than 25,000 people were killed. Over 5 million have been affected from the leak of poisonous gas from that factory in December of 1984. By sponsoring London Olympics, Dow Chemicals wants to show its human face to the world, but the entire world knows its devil face already, says a leading activist fighting for the Bhopal gas survivors. It's the Olympics, ladies and gentlemen. It's a movement. And we all need one. Every day. Wow, I feel like my character's been built just saying those things. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what's up with the Army Corps of Engineers? Well, after years of fighting the government, Bunnatine Bunny Greenhouse, a whistleblower who was demoted after exposing problems with a sole source contract related to the invasion of Iraq, has won an almost $1 million settlement. That's the decision of a U.S. District Court in Washington. This was lost wages. Don't do the joke. Compensatory damages and attorney fees. Beyond the particulars of her situation, Greenhouse says her case makes it loud and clear that federal employees need better laws to protect them if they engage in whistleblowing. Greenhouse was a high-profile government whistleblower inside the Army Corps of Engineers. It involved a Halliburton subsidiary. Oh, now the liberals are taking listen. Kellogg Brown and Root. The Pentagon did not respond for a request for comment. Greenhouse was the civilian procurement executive for the Corps. She objected to KBR using its own cost projections for a multi-year, no-bid, no-competition contract. She initially objected within the Corps, later spoke to Congress about the contract. After she complained to Congress, she was kicked out of the senior executive service and stripped of her top-secret clearance. Legislation that would enhance current whistleblowing protections has been considered by Congress for years without ever gaining final approval. That's because Congress doesn't need it. They got their own protection. If the whistleblowers could vote on Congress's protection, then see, now you have a thing. Greenhouse has been a strong advocate for greater protections. And the president of the National Whistleblower Center called her an American hero. But more about the Corps. Yeah. Army Corps of Engineers spent how much time, do you think, discussing whether designs for pump stations and three New Orleans canals could withstand storm surge pressure? How long do you think the officials spent considering whether those designs were up to the job? Less time than the jury took to acquit O.J. Simpson. Specifically, less than 5 minutes. Even though that element was a key aspect of the project, needed to prevent another flood of New Orleans, like the one that the Corps caused in 2005. For complete information, see The Big Uneasy. Instead of evaluating the proposal on their own, officials trusted claims by the contractor which won the contract for the project that the pump's foundations would hold up, claims that were disputed by another firm that was competing for the contract. The lack of a proper evaluation of a critical aspect of the proposal to build so-called permanent pump stations for the three canals is just one of several technical and procedural problems detailed in the findings of the Government Accountability Office, requiring the Corps to reevaluate the bids for the $750 million project. The decision also chronicles the Corps' failure to properly compensate for the advantage the winning bidder gained by hiring a former Corps official who helped design the bid. And it raised questions about whether any design for the London Avenue pump, one of the three pumps in question, will perform up to the agency's specifications, says the GAO's Managing Associate General Counsel for Procurement Law. At the end of the day, there are some disturbing findings in this decision. The GAO found the Corps barely evaluated major technical issues, like the depth of the piles used in the project. Oh, that wasn't a problem before. No problem. The manner they connected to the rest of the structure and other issues. The Corps barely evaluated such issues, based largely on testimony from the head of the committee that reviewed the technical aspects of the bids. That official, who was not named in the GAO's decision, noted if the design did not meet the requirements, quote, New Orleans could be inundated with water, as it was during Hurricane Katrina. Unquote. But the official said he didn't think about whether the successful bidder's proposal was adequate until he learned it was being challenged. When asked how long the committee discussed that aspect of the project, he replied, I don't remember it being very long. It was more, does it look reasonable? When a GAO official asked if the discussion took 5 minutes, the Corps official replied, maybe, and I'm not even sure it was that long. The Corps official defended that lack of evaluation by saying the Corps would review the specifics of the plan later in the process. You know, like after it's too late? No, after the contract is awarded. He said that such an approach was common when a single contractor is responsible. Though a decision by GAO noted that the Corps' own criteria required that it actually evaluate the design. It's your Corps of Engineers, ladies and gentlemen. Unfortunately, it's mine too. And now,
clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
I thought I'd never live to see this. Adam, are you wearing a kilt?
Well, that's what it feels like.
All right. What's anything underneath?
Yeah, proton.
Okay. That's what I thought. Ladies and gentlemen, the Energy Department, handing out research grants in all kinds of energy fields that are low in carbon dioxide emissions, announces this week it'll give $39 million to universities around the country to try to solve various nuclear problems. I didn't think we had any. Two researchers at Clemson will get $1 million to study the behavior of particles of nuclear waste when buried in clay in metal canisters that have rusted. That couldn't happen. One open question is how high a temperature, which would be generated by the waste itself, affects the interactions. These are important to understand how the waste would spread over time. The goal is to, quote, reduce uncertainty, unquote, about the life expectancy of atomic particles. Huh. I'm not an... Oh, you're uncertain? Really? Okay, then. With the cancellation of the Yucca Mountain waste dump, many nuclear operators are loading older fuel into sealed metal casks filled with inert gas. MIT will get a grant to study how such dry casks perform in salt environments. Storage casks are stored mostly in coastal or lakeside regions where a salt air environment exists. Cracking related to corrosion could occur in 30 years or less, and the NRC is studying whether the casks can be used for 100 years, as some hope. And another important concern in the nuclear power field is the aging of reactors. Researchers at Penn State will get almost $500,000 to plan a system that will use ultrasonic waves to look for cracks and other defects in hot metal parts. I got excited for a minute. I'm sorry. Reported levels of radioactive contamination in Japanese beef are above international safety guidelines, but not enough to pose a significant health threat to people eating the beef, according to UK experts who've been working with colleagues in Japan. Is it a threat to people watching the people eating the beef? No, I would not see it as a significant public health risk, says Jim Smith, a radio ecologist at the University of Portsmouth. If you eat a kilogram of meat with that level of contamination, you are not going to be significantly at risk, unless you know how much a kilogram is. No, he didn't say that. Because of the difficulty of monitoring over such a wide area, I'm surprised we have not seen more incidents like this. I expect that something like this will happen again. Today, 25 years after Chernobyl, some parts of northern Europe still have levels of cesium-137 high enough to justify restrictions on moving and selling livestock. I would not be surprised if there were control on foodstuffs in Japan for many years to come, says one of the visiting experts. Tea has so far been the most affected vegetable in areas well away from Fuk. That is mystifying us all at the moment, says one of the visiting experts from England. Get a grant, babe. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is undertaking a study to ensure that spent fuel pools at Peach Bottom Atomic Power Station can maintain safety guidelines despite the degradation of a material used to control the waste. At issue is Boraflex, which, based on the name, I'd guess contains boron. So why don't they just use Boraxo? I don't know. The spent fuel is still highly radioactive when it's placed in the cooling pool. The temperature of the waste drops dramatically within a few months. Conditions must be controlled to make sure it doesn't start fission. To this end, Boraflex plant panels are installed. But gamma rays, the strongest form of radiation, have caused shrinkage in the Boraflex. So NRC inspectors will examine whether the existing material is safe for use until 2014, when the owner of the plant, Exelon, plans to replace it. Failure of the system could cause boiling of water in the fuel pool, or the release of radioactivity. There are 19 reactors nationwide that use Boraflex, and problems have also been noted at other facilities. So, no, it's fine. Don't you worry about a thing. Exelon has known since 1996 that there was degradation to the material. That's 10 years after the material was approved for Peach Bottom. It's been in there since the mid-80s and had not held up the way they envisioned, says a spokesperson for the NRC. Yeah, it's that vision thing. That'll get you. And Florida utility regulators are considering an expansion of nuclear power in the state, and how much of the bill will be shouldered by ratepayers. Really? But it's cheap. The Florida Public Service Commission this week began considering proposals from Florida Power and Light that would allow them to pass on about $365 million in nuclear energy-related costs to customers. Florida Power and Light is asking for about almost $200 million next year to help upgrade nuclear plants and to move forward on a plan to build two new reactors at Turkey Point. I didn't choose the name. Why are you looking at me?
I'm not looking at you.
I wasn't talking to you. That would amount to about $2 a month for 1,000 kilowatt hours of residential electricity use, up from the 33 cents a month authorized just last year. But it's cheap because it's safe. Florida Power and Light estimates the total cost of the improvements in new reactors will be between $13 and $19 billion. I got that on me. And they say regulators must consider whether the possibility of another U.S. recession and the fallout from Fukushima might make the price tag even more expensive for projects that may never be built. Oh, come on now. Addy?
I'd build them.
Yeah, but you're wearing a kilt. Clean, cheap, too safe to meter. Our friend, the atom. Now let's return to our conversation with tax expert David K. Johnston. Let's get back to offshoring. If the repatriation bills didn't pass, and I'm not enough of a naive to think they won't pass this time as well as they did last time, but if the companies can't repatriate their profits from, you know, poor old Bermuda or Cayman Islands, are they able to assert operational use of the money even though it's never been repatriated into the United States?
It's a little complicated. If you have $100 billion in your offshore account, you can't go to your bankers in America and say, loan us $100 billion here and we'll pledge that as collateral. That's what you do when you buy your house, right? Mm-hmm. Let me live in this house and I'll pledge the house as collateral through a mortgage. But when you go to your banker and you say, look, we need to borrow some money, and by the way, you know perfectly well we have $100 billion sitting over there in this tax haven, and we need to borrow $50 billion to do X or Y, you can get the loan on pretty good terms. So they certainly have access to this money.
Well, let me just pursue that for a second. If it's so simple to just rent a mailbox and have a subsidiary in Bermuda, if you had the telephone number or the email address of a Bermudan lawyer, why couldn't, you know, Jim's Drugstore do that?
Well, because in order to do that, you've got to have, first of all, enough scale to afford the costs of it. Many of the tax shelter devices that I've exposed over the years, and they literally have totaled many hundreds of billions of dollars on a 10-year basis. In theory, you and I could go do, but to do it, you really have to have a huge amount of money. I mean, some of them come with, for example, $1 million upfront fee just for an opinion letter from a lawyer that will keep you from going to prison if the government finds out about it.
That's an expensive get-out-of-jail-free card, in other words.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
So the table stakes are high, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. This is not the $2 table at Binion's in Vegas. This is the $5,000 or $50,000 private room at Wynn.
Yeah, this is the baccarat table upstairs at Wynn's.
Yes.
Do companies get any other benefits from this offshore apparatus that extends around the world other than tax benefits? Is it just basically done for tax dodging?
Yeah, it is basically a tax benefit. And the real problem these companies face, Harry, is this. They can't use that money to buy back their stock. And that's what they want to do. One of the big stories in America that's very important to understand about why your investments are what they are and what's happening to wealth and income is that many, many companies are using most of their profits to buy back their stock, and then they issue to executives an amount of stock equal to what they bought back. And it's a way to pump up executive pay, and it damages all the rest of the investors over a long period of time. And in the case of Pfizer, where they spent their tax savings and their repatriated money almost exclusively to buy back their stock, it didn't work. The price of Pfizer has continued to fall, and I think now it's about half what it was when that Jobs Creation Act, that I call the Jobs Destruction Act, was passed 7 years ago.
You're saying Pfizer needs Viagra for its stock price.
It's exactly. It's very good. I wish I'd thought of that, Harry. That's why you're a comedian, and I'm an investigative reporter.
Yeah.
They need Viagra for their stock.
But do they get any kind of regulatory benefit from offshoring?
Not really. I mean, the one of the challenges I think we face is that corporations in the modern world have become so incredibly complex. What you see as the New York Times or CBS or General Motors, a company with that brand name, in fact, internally is hundreds and in some cases thousands of separate little companies. Every corporate jet is its own corporation. And all of this
with
is
its own board of, with its own board of directors?
That's well, technically, yes.
Yeah.
That they're internal executives and so these structures, which are all designed to limit liability and limit taxes and are a full employment program for corporate lawyers, regulators really, I believe, you can't expect government-grade regulators to truly understand these things. And the IRS actually admitted, I don't know, in response to some story I wrote when I was at the New York Times, that Enron was so complicated, just that company, Enron, that they really didn't understand what was going on inside Enron.
Well, that's the same thing we heard during the financial crisis, that regulators just couldn't keep up with the complexity of derivatives and of CDOs and CDSs and the pyramid of debt that was being built. Isn't that sort of...
Exactly. And the few people who did get it, like Brixley Bourne, of course, were immediately slapped down by politicians and told, you know, stay out of this. This isn't your business. When, in fact, that's exactly the point of regulation.
Yeah. So it is a Jobs Creation Act for corporate lawyers.
Yes. In fact, all of the tax law changes we're making, you know, for the last 30 years, we've had this incredible growing remake of the tax code. Every year, you may only hear about a few stories in the news. There are thousands of changes being made in the tax law, often to benefit one individual or a handful or a small industry or to gain an advantage for one industry against another. And many of them, they don't have a label on them. If you read the thing, you would never know what it means unless somebody tips somebody like me off to what it is and shows you how to walk through it. And so that's why we have this just terrible, indefensible mess of a tax code.
And whom did you anger when you were in school that you inherited the job of reading all this stuff and trying to figure it out?
I actually asked for this, Harry. I was, 30 years ago, I was the guy at the L.A. Times who remade the reputation of the LAPD and revealed the worldwide spying they were doing and the brutality and the failure to solve a lot of crimes. But I started to become interested in wealthy people and taxes because of two scandals in California. One of them was the Hiltons. Conrad Hilton left his fortune to the starving children of the earth, and I exposed how his son Barron arranged to divert the money to himself, and he ultimately got about two-thirds of it. And then the Keck brothers, as in the Keck telescope, made this deal with then-candidate for governor Duke Majan, who was attorney general and who was supposed to be the guardian of charitable trusts, to get $1 million a year in what I called anti-pauper insurance, that is anti-poverty insurance, from their father's charitable fund. Mm. And that's when my eyes sort of opened up to, you know, there's more to this tax system than what I'd been hearing.
Then more of the tax system than Form 1040.
And what comes out of your paycheck. And I began to realize that, you know, there are people who are getting rich off this. And what is it? It's taken me 20 years. And I assure you there's no small number of detractors out there who will tell you I have no idea what I'm doing.
But you do have a Pulitzer Prize to show for it, right?
I do. And I also have an unusual distinction. I am not a lawyer. In fact, I'm not a college graduate, though I have a college education, including graduate school. But I am a professor of law and a professor of graduate accounting at Syracuse University.
Wow. Without ever having graduated from college?
Yeah. I have a college education.
Yeah, no, I understand.
The University of Chicago Graduate School, but never got a diploma because I never stayed in one college long enough.
You and Sarah Palin.
Yep. Not somebody I particularly identify with.
You're not usually lumped in with her, but there you go. David, anything more we need to know about this offshoring that I haven't been smart enough to ask you about in terms of how it works or whom it benefits and whom it hurts?
Well, here's the other thing I think people should think about offshoring. The techniques that are used by wealthy Americans and large corporations offshore are the very same techniques that not nice people who want to blow people up and kill people and undertake revolutions, and people who are in the drug business, as with the incredible explosion epidemic of murder and violence we're seeing right across the border in Mexico, they use the same techniques. So we should be thinking about international flows of money in terms not just of tax and tax avoidance and tax evasion, but in terms of stability, in terms of avoiding war and death and conflict, and having a regulatory regime that serves the interests of stability, democracy, and the liberties of the people.
Thank you so much. I've read you for years, and you've done the impossible, which is make me understand this stuff, and I wanted to share that gift with the audience today, and it's really a treat to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Harry, very much for having me on.
Appreciate it.
By the hill and do the next thing that you feel. We were so in phase in a dance hall days. We were cool on craze when I, you and everyone we knew could believe, do sharing what was true. I said, that's all day's love. Take your baby by the hair and pull her closer, there. And take your baby by the ears and play upon her darkest fears. We were so in phase in a dance hall days. We were cool on craze when I, you and everyone we knew could believe, do share in what was true. I said, dance all day's love. Dance all days. Dance all days long. Take your baby by the wrist and in her mouth an amethyst, and in her red just sapphire's blue, and you need her and she needs you. 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 We were so in phase in a dance hall days. We were cool and crazy when I, you, and everyone we knew could believe, do, and share in what was true. Oh, I said, dance all day's love. Dance all day's.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Oh, let's start with a caddy, shall we? How about super caddy Steve Williams? He took to his website to issue a statement about his comments Sunday after the bridge, last Sunday after the Bridgestone Invitational. He was criticized for talking about himself and not the golfer he was working for who won when interviewed by CBS. Quote, there's been considerable debate following the comments I made at the conclusion of Sunday's Bridgestone Invitational. It was a complete surprise to have the CBS announcer ask for an interview. My emotions following Adam's victory were running very high, and at the time I felt my emotions poured out and got the better of me. I apologize to my fellow caddies and professionals for failing to mention Adam's outstanding performance. I would like to thank all of those fans at Firestone who made this victory the most special of my career. See, he didn't mention Adam again, and he didn't mention Bridgestone. University of Kansas basketball player Thomas Robinson is sorry. The junior forward has apologized for spitting on a bouncer during an altercation at the Cave nightclub in Lawrence, Kansas. They have nightclubs in Kansas. The Lawrence Journal World reported, though the bouncer didn't want to press charges, Robinson completed 20 hours of community service and then wrote the letter of apology. Quote, I hope you can forgive me for this serious lapse of judgment, he wrote. I'm very embarrassed about my behavior that night. I now realize you have a difficult job, and I'm sorry for making it tougher that evening. Robinson was cited for misdemeanor battery, which I believe is a AA offense. Hernandario Gomez, the coach of the Colombian national soccer team, apologized for punching a woman who insulted him by criticizing his job performance. Witnesses said Gomez struck the woman twice at the entrance to a bar on Saturday night. See, it's the bars. This act shames me in front of my mother, my wife, and each and every one of the women in my country and in my family, Gomez says. He realizes he was wrong for punching the woman. Being a soccer coach, he should have kicked her. English celebrity magazine Grazia has admitted to altering a cover photo of Kate Middleton to make her skinnier. The May 9th special royal wedding issue featured a doctored photo of the Duchess, or a Duchess photo of the doctor, in her Alexander McQueen wedding gown, in which Middleton appeared to have an extremely narrow waist. The magazine apologized for the incident, which had already sparked a debate over the magazine's practices. Last week, L'Oreal was forced to remove two ads from magazines after it was revealed the photo images had been altered. The ads, both for anti-aging creams, featured actress Julia Roberts and supermodel Christy Turlington and were deemed misleading. If you can be a supermodel, you can be a super caddy. That's all I think. No, that's not all I think. More than a month after he was accidentally shot during an Old West gunfight reenactment, Pittsburgh resident John Ellis says he's been contacted by only one person affiliated with the show, the shooter. The optometrist remains off the job after being shot June 17th in the forearm and elbow while on his vacation with his family in Hill City, South Dakota, in the Black Hills National Forest. He was about among 100 spectators as actors began a final battle with five or six guns which were supposed to be filled with blanks. Somehow, the gun used by one reenactor had live rounds. He fired four bullets into the crowd, wounding Ellis and two others. Ellis says he got a conversation with the shooter. He said he never intended to do anything like that and apologized, and he is the only one that has contacted me so far. No one else from the city or Wild West organization or Chamber of Commerce has contacted me. The arrest in Belarus last week on suspicion of tax evasion of an activist, human rights activist, drew international condemnation. It's emerged since then that members of the European Union helped the case against him by providing the authorities in Minsk with his banking information, or his banksking information. Lithuania has already apologized to his family, Mr. Bialyatsky, who heads one of the most prominent human rights groups in Belarus. Now, Poland, who has been a staunch defender of opposition groups in Belarus, has admitted it also divulged information about bank accounts in his name. Polish Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski has apologized for the leak. I'm so sorry on behalf of the Republic, he wrote on Twitter, calling the disclosure a reprehensible mistake and vowing to redouble efforts to support democracy in Belarus. Camille Grammer has apologized to ex-husband Kelsey Grammer for insulting the size of his penis. According to gossip website TMZ, she had made a remark, big hands, big feet, big disappointment. Her official apology was issued via the same website. Some joking remarks I made got picked up and caused my ex-husband great embarrassment, and for that, I sincerely apologize. For more than a decade, federal prosecutors say Mark Chiavarella perpetrated a profound evil upon juveniles in Lucerne County, that's where Scranton, Pennsylvania is, unjustly incarcerating them as part of a scheme to enrich himself. This week, he found himself on the receiving end of a 28-year prison sentence that will assure he probably will spend most of his rest of his life in prison, and also ordered to pay nearly $1.2 million in restitution. I said restitution. Addressing the court, Chiavarella acknowledged he illegally accepted money from a builder of juvenile detention centers. He denied he ever jailed a juvenile in exchange for cash. I blame no one but myself for what has happened. I had an opportunity to say no to taking money I believed was legal to receive, but I knew that I should not take because it was wrong and unethical for me to do so. He apologized to his family, citizens of the county, his former colleagues on the bench, and probation department employees. He also apologized to juveniles who appeared before him, saying he hoped they could forgive him, quote, for being a hypocrite by not practicing what I preached, unquote. The president of Tokai TV, a station in Nagoya, Japan, publicly apologized this week for a prank that mocked victims of the triple disaster that hit Japan in March. Egypt's prime minister apologized to a priest who was forced to take off his robes by a Cairo hotel security official, saying the Ministry of Tourism is investigating the incident. I strongly denounce the offensive search in which Father Iwida was subjected at one of Cairo's hotels, the prime minister said. The priest was there at the hotel to attend an iftar. Not an ishtar, an iftar. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show from Edinburgh. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world by the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like people not coming up with their tried and true ideological explanations for every single news event that occurs if you'd agree to join me then. But you really already, thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks to Andre Croucher at WXXI for help with today's broadcast, and thanks as always to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer, and The Big Uneasy becomes available this week on digital platforms. Information at TheBigUneasy.com. And I'll see you in Brooklyn this week at BAM with The Big Uneasy. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from Edinburgh.